All right, well, it's Al.
And Don.
And we're back again for episode 9.
Yeah, Dallas free, Rook free.
Oh, bummer, but they'll be back.
It's just tough. I can't believe how hard it is to get everybody together in one sitting, but it happens.
Well, it's like the Beatles, you know.
Yeah, we're like the Beatles.
In our own minds. So what are we going to talk about today, man?
Well, you and I talked about, and I guess since Dallas isn't on the show, this would be a perfect time, is animation.
Oh, yeah, comic book animation, yeah.
To me, it was always a fine line. I always loved the comic books, and I always loved watching cartoons on television, and unlike most people, when they feel they outgrow it, I never did. It just always seemed like, you know, really close cousins. A lot of times, people like comic books want to animate. So you can imagine my shock when I'm talking to Dallas about the New Frontier. He liked the comic. When I loaned him the DVD, he had no interest because he's not a fan of animation.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I was kind of taken aback a little bit, but I can understand it, you know.
Well, everybody, you know, they have their own things they like and dislike, but to me, it just went hand in hand. Actually, I guess it's a completely different discipline, but...
But I think I was talking to you, and I was thinking about when I got into comics, which was, I guess, like, well, again, that FF 57, which was the first book that I remember ever buying, decided I'm going to collect comics. That was, like, towards the end of 66, and I think that coincided right when those Marvel cartoons came out.
Oh, yeah, the Mighty Marvel Hero. What was it called?
The Mary Marvel Marching Society.
That was my introduction to the Marvel. I never saw the characters before. I lived for about, I think, close to a year in Denver, Colorado, when I was 5 years old. There were certain cartoons I loved that they showed, and at one point in the afternoon, they would show those Marvel cartoons. And I wasn't sure about it. They always had the song, and they showed all the characters with Thor and Captain America. And some of those, Iron Man, they always looked fascinating, but the only ones they ever showed was the Hulk, and a couple times they showed the Submariner. I didn't like the Hulk when I watched it. My friend was always like, why are they showing these? And they kept asking, why didn't they show the guy with the big ears, which is Thor, the feathered helmet? And I guess he did see one of the episodes and said it was pretty good. And but I think at one point they showed Iron Man. I saw him once, and I thought it was a robot. So I don't know what to show about a robot, which you'd think I would really appeal to me. But that was my introduction. And then we left Colorado, and I never saw those again until I was in college. I was really surprised at how bad they were.
Yeah, it wasn't the greatest, but you know what? They fascinate me. I love them. I think I like them better than some cartoons like that people think are great animation.
Well, they were using actual source material.
That's what I liked about it, yeah.
They were using actual Marvel comics. When I was in college, there was a station in Abilene, Texas that would show them. And that's when I at first I was putting them down like, well, this is no good. Some of them were. I liked the Captain America episodes. I liked some of the Thor episodes. And it was neat how they would show it and how they'd move some of it. You know, it wasn't the greatest, but there was an art to it that was kind of unique.
Yeah, oh yeah, definitely. And it was like, wow, there's Kirby. There's
yeah.
Ditko. And in some episodes, you'd get Kirby art, Ditko art, and maybe even Don Heck art. So you'd be like all over the place, you know?
I like how they changed the colors, too. Sometimes it seemed like they were kind of bright and day glow.
Yeah, and around, I guess those were the first. I think in 67, the year later, they did the Fantastic Four and the Spider-Mans came
yeah.
out. And the FFs were Hanna-Barbera, so it was like more, it was better animation. The Spider-Man was Ralph Bakshi.
Yeah, it was Ralph Bakshi.
Yeah, and those were a little better, a lot better, actually.
Well, the Fantastic Four, as I said in an earlier episode, I had one of the issues, I think it was in the 60s, 68 or something. A week later, that cartoon came on. I mean, you know, I loved it. I loved the Spider-Man just as much. And they were on for a couple of years, and then they just disappeared. I never saw them again. I was actually on a basketball tournament up in, of all places, Miami, Oklahoma.
Wow.
And they were showing in the hotel, like, what, Spider-Man? And that's when I realized it was Ralph Bakshi, who was the Wizards guy, you know. And I guess some towns would have them in syndication, but it was rare to ever see that stuff anymore.
Oh, yeah, I remember watching them. I think they came out the same year as the FF, but one, I think one of them was maybe CBS, and the other one was NBC or ABC. I don't know. I seem to remember, if you look at the comic books from that era, they have an advertising for the Saturday morning lineup, and I think they had the FF, I think the Spider-Mans came on, and then somewhere along the line they had the Beetle cartoons too.
Yeah.
So it was just like, oh my God, that was heaven for me. You know?
Yeah, I love those. I love the Beetle cartoon.
I think even Casper was around there too, you know. So,
yeah.
Oh yeah.
The Caspers were older. They were kind of
Harvey Toons.
Yeah, the Harvey Toons. But they I think it was Famous Studios who did the Popeye cartoons. After they took they took that studio away from the Fleischer brothers. It was Famous Studios, and then later they brought in all the Harvey stuff, Casper and everything. Do you know who designed Casper? Who created him?
No.
Joe Oriolo.
Oh, Felix the Cat.
Yeah, well, he didn't create Felix the Cat.
He didn't.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it was Otto Mesmer.
Yeah, Otto Mesmer. But Joe Oriolo, I guess he got the rights to it, and he completely redesigned him. You know, he took him and made the more modern Felix with the round head and the streamline. And those cartoons he did, you're right at the top to me. We moved to Oklahoma City, and you know, every town I lived in always had a guy that had a cartoon show, and he's usually dressed as a clown or a cowboy. And Oklahoma City was no exception, and they always showed the Felix the Cat cartoons. And
great theme song too.
Oh yeah,
I'm not gonna sing it though.
my daughter, when she was little, she could sing it. I bought a videotape when, you know, VCRs were popular. I bought it at the drugstore, and I hadn't seen those cartoons. They always showed them in Oklahoma in black and white. And when I moved there, all the TVs are black and white. But they had, when everybody switched to color, all the way up through the 70s, those cartoons were black and white. I thought that's how they were filmed. So I bought the tape, and they were in this fantastic bright color. Kind of find out it is how they did the cartoons. I don't know. I guess they sent black and white tapes to the TV shows, TV stations.
Yeah, I don't know how that works, but okay.
But anyway, he bought the rights. Joe Oriolo is actually kind of interesting because he created Casper the Friendly Ghost for his daughter. She was afraid of the dark. And he also brought over, I guess he created a company called Translux.
Translux, yeah.
Which brought over Speed Racer.
Yeah.
But he also brought over...
He didn't bring over Astro Boy, did he?
I don't know. I actually never... I loved Astro Boy, but I never saw the show. I knew him... it's just like Bazooka Joe Bubblegum. You could get the little bubblegum, but they had tattoos of Astro Boy in them. I didn't know who he was. I just liked the art style. But I had never seen the show. But Joe Oriolo also brought over with Translux. I think the first show he brought from Japan was called Ape Man.
Oh, yeah, Ape Man. Is that the one where he like gets a superpower by smoking
yeah.
or something like that? That's awesome.
I never saw this. I was reading about it online back in the 90s. And, yeah, he got his superpower by smoking a cigarette, which now I understand why they don't show him anymore. Which is, that leads you to another one. The cartoonist that created Ape-Man, I don't know, it was a manga, you know, the comic book.
Yeah, they were comic books, along with Astro Boy.
But the guy that created it ended up doing Batman, you know, in Japan.
He is that that Bat-Manga book?
Yeah, that I love so much. He was the cartoonist. I never heard of this. I found it in San Francisco at the Cartoon Art Museum. And the book is incredible. It has a really nice kind of paragraph, half a page, with a picture of this man now. And they interview him for, like I said, a brief mention. But they said, why did you do the Batman? Well, Batman was huge because of the 1966 TV show. And he wanted to try his hand at American comic books. And he said the reason he did Batman is because he didn't do Superman. I guess they offered Superman to him at one point. He was too busy with his own work.
Mm.
So he passed it up. So he said he wasn't going to do it again. So he did the Batman. My question now is, did they do a Superman, you know, comic book in Japan? And who did it?
I'd like to
see that one.
Now, the guy who did the Bat-Manga, what's his name? I missed it.
I never said it. I can't remember his name.
It's not Tezuka. Tezuka was Astro Boy.
It was Astro Boy. As a matter of fact, this cartoonist mentioned Tezuka. Basically, he was talking about how Osamu Tezuka changed everything. And he said he really upped the game for everybody. And he said when he saw what Tezuka was doing, it changed it for him. They all started getting more serious and pushing it.
I remember as a kid, when I first came to the U.S., we lived in New York, and Astro Boy would fascinate me. I was like, I'm talking like 64, maybe 63. I was like, wow, this is really cool. And that might be the first, one of the first animes that was ever made. And I just remember it was so interesting because it was like the kid was, you know, was a robot, but even though he was a robot, you had feelings, and I just thought that was the most interesting thing.
I love the art style. Like I said, yeah, I saw it on these bubblegum tattoo things you could get, and I was amazed how he had, you know, jetpacks on his feet.
Right, his feet used to disappear and the jetpacks would...
I love the cartoon style. And in Colorado, like I said, we lived in Denver for a year. My favorite show, and it has remained my favorite show, was a Japanese cartoon called Prince Planet.
I love Prince Planet.
It's, you know, and it's funny because most people never knew it. I watched it in Colorado, then we moved to Oklahoma City. Nobody had ever seen it, and it just seemed like a dream. The only way I actually knew it was real and I didn't imagine it was my cousin moved to Colorado in the early 70s. And he said, there's a cartoon you got to come up and see. And it's Prince Planet. And I was telling about all the characters. You know, we both loved it. It just completely went away until I was online in 96 and looked it up and found it. My daughter was kind of fascinated. She was 5 at the time. She came over and saw it. She goes, oh, that's neat. What is this? She jumped in my lap. And I said, well, you know how you like the Power Rangers. When I was your age, this is my very favorite. She liked the medallion. And I was trying to open... You got to remember, this is 96. I had a 36.6, you know, modem, a dial-up. And she goes, what are you doing? I says, well, I'm waiting to listen to the theme song. She got all excited. And then she kept asking me questions. And it took forever to download. It took, you know, a few minutes. And so I sang parts of the song I could remember. When the song came up, it was singing, she got so delighted. Daddy, it's exactly the way you sing it. You know, 30 years later, I can't remember any of my passcodes, but I remember the theme song to Prince Planet.
Oh, man. Yeah, I remember seeing that on Miami TV back in, but I didn't see it till the 70s. I don't remember seeing it in the 60s.
Yeah, I was watching it in 1966. I never saw it again until I went online and started seeing pictures of it, and you could hear the theme song. And I heard about people who had the videotapes. I guess it was real popular in Australia. And I never got any. I finally, on LiveJournal, I met somebody. As a matter of fact, he's linked to our blog. It's a site called Zenorama. And he was actually the first human being besides my cousin and people I knew in Colorado that knew it. And he was sharing links. It's on Hulu. They have really good copies of it on Hulu that
Prince
you can
Planet,
watch for
right?
free. Yeah, Prince Planet. I don't think they have all the episodes. But and the show was done in black and white. There aren't color versions of it.
Right.
But,
right.
Yeah, I would love to have actually a nice commercial set of it.
The original Astro Boys aren't in color either.
I don't think so.
No, I think they were in black and white.
No, those were... my daughter had seen some of those late night on Cartoon Network. You know, she'd tell me.
You're right.
And I'd watch them. They actually looked really nice. They were good quality.
And the Prince Planets were, I mean, like I said, 64, I remember. That was before the Marvel superheroes and all that stuff was showing on TV. So that was like real early exposure to that stuff for me.
They were, you know, I guess the closest thing I think of an American comic would be Green Lantern. It reminded me a bit of Green Lantern. It was unique. And I love the art style. And every once in a while, there'd be some TV show they'd show one time, you know, in Oklahoma, like some kind of special or movie, and it was from Japan. I didn't know at the time. But every time I see, that's that Prince Planet looking thing. And it was, I guess, before I graduated high school when I found out those are actually Japanese cartoons.
Right.
But you could not find this stuff here. Once in a while in the back of some magazine, you have a thing where you could send off for Japanese comics. But they were expensive, and it was hard to see exactly what you were getting. So.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. But yeah, anyway, the Marvel cartoons were the first time I probably saw those characters on the magazine rack, because that was the first time I really understood what they were all about. And the interesting thing was those were actually made in Canada by some Lawrence Gantre was the company, and like the only voice that I recognize on her, did I don't know if you ever knew this, was John Vernon. You know who John Vernon is?
No, no.
Remember, and did you see ever see Animal House?
Yeah.
Dean Warmer?
Oh, no.
That's him. He's one of the main voices in there, yeah.
Well, I can see that because he has a bigger-than-life voice.
Uh-huh,
he was on an episode of Gunsmoke one time.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, he just has this strong, domineering voice, bigger than life. I could see that.
And then the FF ones that were done by Hanna-Barbera, those were, the storyboards were by Toth.
Yeah, well, he did a lot of the character designs. There was a really fantastic book called Toth Black and White. And the whole book, it had some sketches, but most of it was the model sheets he did for Hanna-Barbera. And the guy that put the book together was a good friend of Toth's. And all through it, Toth, in his own handwriting, described, you know, how he came up with it, and how Joe Barbera was pushing the show, and how they designed it. And when he gets to the Fantastic Four, he was talking about it. He was completely against the cartoon. He didn't want to do it. He said, you know, it was a comic book by Jack Kirby, and they were going to try to translate it to the show, and he said he just didn't think it would work. His style was completely different from anything Jack Kirby did, but they were insistent that they got the license, they were going to put it out, and so he did his best, and he said when it was all finished, he was really surprised. It turned out to be quite a nice cartoon, and it is. It's, again, it's remained one of my very favorite animated shows ever done. And what I really liked the most about that is how they went back to the old source material. Character designs, you know, the stories, artwork. They didn't copy it, they translated it, but it just stands up. It's fantastic.
Right, and the Spider-Mans, if I remember correctly, I remember reading, they came out with a box set a few years ago, and Gray Morrow did layouts for some of those. Cause I looked at the credits at the end, and I saw something like layouts by Gray Morrow, and that's another one of the guys that I'll have to talk about it in a future show. That was one of my favorite all-time guys or whatever. But, yeah, he was involved in that. And the Spider-Man has that awesome theme song, too. You know,
yeah.
Like covered by the Ramones in an unbelievably great version.
Yeah, it is an unbelievably great version. And the Spider-Man cartoon, like I said, I'd seen it once or twice again in high school when I was in Miami, Oklahoma.
Not Miami, Florida, where
yeah.
I was.
But, I don't remember too much about it. I loved it when I was younger. That was one of the things in the playground in first grade everybody always talked about. I remember the show was nice. I really liked the fact that they used the bad guys from the comics on the show. I remember there was Mysterio, which always creeped me out.
The Vulture.
Yeah, they had all that. It was a really good show.
Yeah, yeah.
But,
and then I think a few years after that, the Filmation... No, I think it was right after that. Filmation got a hold of the DC characters, and they were doing the Superman Batman Hour, and they had Aquaman and Flash and all that stuff, you know?
Well, you're absolutely right. The Superman was first. I remember when I was a kid, this is in, I guess, 65 or 66, they had that cartoon for Superman.
Okay, all right.
And then in 66, they were advertising the Superman Aquaman Hour, and I'd never seen Aquaman. That was, again, my introduction to the character. It was really nice. And then I guess a year or two later, or a year later, that's when they put in the Batman show.
Right.
But I guess when it was after the Superman Aquaman Hour, or maybe during that time, they had some of the other characters. I remember they had the Teen Titans.
Superboy.
And they had
Flash.
Flash and Green Lantern and the Atom.
Yep, exactly,
and
yeah.
I'd never seen any of those characters. Again, Green Lantern really fascinated me.
It's funny, it's from talking, it seems like we probably were introduced to a lot of these characters by the TV shows.
Well, there's a guy I work with. I mentioned him on the episode we're talking about the digital comics. James, I'm talking about you. But James talks about to this day. He likes comics. He doesn't read them as much. But whenever he talks about some of the Marvel stuff, it's always the cartoons. He always brings up a Spider-Man cartoon, I guess they did on MTV.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
And sometimes we always kind of tease him because he was talking about, I guess Electro was Red Skull's son. And, you know, I don't read too many, you know, Marvel comics much anymore. And I said, what? And he said, oh, it was on the Spider-Man cartoon. And there was a running joke, another guy we worked with would always call out the Red Skull has a son? But, you know, a lot of times when James mentions something to me, it's always an introduction. His introduction is the cartoons, and that's what he knows. Even though Dallas isn't a fan of animation, I think he did love the G.I. Joe. I think he liked Thundercats, some of the 80s stuff, which those are really well-done shows. But, again, to me, most of the stuff that I loved, as you mentioned, I learned off the animated cartoons first and then went to the comics later.
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely. I never really thought about it, but, yeah, it was really the TV that got me into it because I probably had picked up a few, and the Batman TV show, like, that came out in 66. Yeah. That was a big influence on everything. That was like a, that was almost like, I was talking to another friend of mine, that was almost like the Beatles or something, you know, how big that was.
Well, that was a pop culture phenomenon. And like I said, that's why they did that comic book in Japan.
Batman
was because the Batman TV show.
Oh, yeah.
I think everybody was introduced to him. You know, that Batman TV show, we just left Texas. We were living in Lawton, Oklahoma for about, I don't know, a year. And my dad came up and said, Batman's coming on TV. I didn't know anything about Batman. I said, what is that? And he says, the guy that dresses up like a bat. Oh, you know, I was 4 years old at the time. The only bat I was even aware of was a baseball bat. And I kept trying to imagine a guy wearing a baseball bat suit. It didn't sound very interesting to me. And then later, I saw, I guess it was that beach show, Hullabaloo,
yeah.
They had all these kids dressed up with Robin singing Batman with these smoking guns and stuff.
That's awesome.
And, you know, I was at a preschool I was at. We were all sitting there watching, and every kid in there was just jumping up and down, couldn't wait. That show just blew the roof off of everything. Remember the bat rings you used to get out of Fritos?
Oh, gosh. Here's one for you. I don't know if you guys had them, but you probably did. Down in South Florida, Miami, where I used to live, you used to get all the Batman stuff at Mr. Donut. Did you ever have a Mr. Donut?
No, I don't remember
that. It was a donut chain, and you went in there, and when you bought your donuts or whatever, you'd get, like, some Batman cards or a Batman ring. They had donuts like Robin Raspberry, Joker Jelly, you know, but it was like, of all places, I just remember going there with my grandparents because the one lady who worked there was a friend of ours, and she'd give me like a stack of Batman cards after I'd get a donut or something.
Oh,
it was totally awesome.
There was a convenience store in Lawton, Oklahoma called Gagels, which I thought was a funny name. But they had one time in the freezer where all the popsicles and stuff was, they had the bat signal. It was banana ice cream. And the bat emblem was a piece of chocolate cake, you know, shaped like it. But they were wrapped in cellophane. And I was dying for those. So one day, my mom and I walked to the store to get it. And the teenage girl said, yeah, well, they're having some trouble with the freezer, but it should be cool enough. So mom bought it. I walked outside in the parking lot. We're walking home. I opened it up, and it just came apart and hit the ground. I was starting to cry. And the girl came out and says, don't worry. She gave mom the money back. Said, you can come back later, and I'll, you know, when it's frozen. And I'd take my hat off to my mom. We walked all the way back to the house, and later that afternoon went back over there to get me another one. Never forgot that.
But, awesome.
Yeah, Batman stuff was everywhere. The bat rings they had in Fritos, they didn't look like Batman. It was just a plastic ring with a black plastic bat on it.
Right.
But when we moved to Oklahoma City, 6 years old, some of the kids in the neighborhood was hanging out with me, and they said, can you go trick-or-treating with us? My parents said, okay. So there was a bunch of us 6 and 7 year olds all in a pack going around trick-or-treating by ourselves. It was heaven. We got to this one house, and the guy was a bachelor. He just got off work. He, you know, we came up trick-or-treat. He wasn't ready for us. And he said, hold on. And he came back, and he had a little ashtray, and he had bat rings in the cellophane. He must have ate a lot of Fritos. You know, there's nobody to give them to. So I remember he had this whole ashtray of bat rings. He let each one of us get it, and everybody, all right, bat rings! He was the hero of the neighborhood. I guess to him it was just garbage he had, but after that, I remember we walked down the street, and guys, what's it? Harry, who's got these? Where are these? You know, we were pointing the guy out, and everybody's freaking. He must have had 20 of them. I never forgot that guy. Whoever you were, kudos, good life, good spirit to you. I love you, man. I never forgot that.
Wow. All I remember getting out of a box of Fritos was like a Frito Bandito eraser.
Oh, yeah, those
like
are
that.
Good, too.
Yeah. The Frito Bandito, there you go, you know. I'll tell you a funny thing, though, getting back to the Filmation cartoons with the Batman, Superman Hour and all that. You know who did a lot of the voices in those, especially the introductions?
No, no.
Ted Knight.
Well, he did the Super Friends. He was a
comic. Yeah, yeah,
Super
he did
Friends.
That too. Ted Baxter, yeah. It was just like, I never really thought about it when I was a kid, even after watching Mary Tyler Moore, but it was like, Ted Knight, really? You know, I was like, oh, okay, you know, cool.
But you know why they used those guys? There was
radio voices.
Yeah, radio. You know why they used radio voices?
Well, they were all working in New York or something.
Well, see, that's one thing I
never
stood.
They were actors.
Well, Casey Kasem, it's funny because when I went to basketball camp in Miami, Oklahoma when I was in high school, and one of the players, I was riding with him, and he listened to American Top 40, which I had never heard at the time. This is about 77. And we're driving up there, and he said, I said, what is this? I've heard this guy before. Oh, this is a good show. It's American Top 40. You've probably heard it. Well, I never heard it before. But the whole trip, I'm going up there, and I'm just, my brain's twisting itself. So I know this voice. How do I know this voice? And I never knew. Of course, you know, I've gotten to know the show real well. I knew who Casey Kasem was after it. And it wasn't until 95 I found out he was the voice of Shaggy on Scooby-Doo. And then when my daughter was small and watched Cartoon Network all the time, I learned he was the voice of Alex on Josie and the Pussycats. He was the voice of Robin on Super Friends and countless others. And so I never would have put it together that the guy that did American Top 40 was all these cartoon voices that I grew up with. But the reason they used them is in the original animation, they used radio voices because they were radio shows, like we mentioned last episode, The Shadow. They were always, you know, adventure dramas. And they were voice actors. So they'd bring, you know, these same guys over to the animated shows. Well, later radio changed and there was DJs. But they continued the tradition. That's what they do to go get the voice actors is from the radio.
Okay.
And that's where it all came from. But yeah, Ted Knight, which I didn't particularly care for on the Super Friends. I thought it was kind of a uninteresting, depressing drone. You know.
I liked Ted Knight.
Well, some people absolutely loved it. I liked him on Mary Tyler Moore.
He was funny, man.
But as far as the commentator on the Super Friends cartoon, not so much. But.
Well, on the old Filmation Superman, I think it was the first series, the voice of Superman was Bud Collier, and I think he was actually the radio Superman, too. So they actually got the old guy from the 40s to do it, so that was kind of cool. Obviously, I didn't know this at the time. I learned it later on from, you know, a friend of mine who was into all this.
When I was in the Navy, and I was in the Philippines in 84, and they were showing that old Filmation cartoon in the Philippines locally. And
in English?
Yeah. Okay. Well, the Filipinos can
speak English. They all speak English.
Okay. They speak their own language. Usually they speak a couple of other languages.
Right.
And in English. But it was kind of weird because you can see shows in the Philippines. Sometimes they're in Tagalog or another dialect, or they'll be in English. Sometimes you watch a show and they do a mix of all of them.
Oh, yeah.
So I guess if, you know, you're a country that's blessed with people that can speak more than one language, you can do that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But I never realized, I remember watching that, one thing I kind of forgot was whenever they changed the scenes, they'd have some kind of little guitar sound.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
I said, I haven't seen these since I was a kid. But yeah, everybody watched Superman in the Philippines for the old Filmations.
Oh, yeah, sure. You know, and then years later, we got the Super Friends.
Yeah, the Super Friends, which up until the 90s was the longest running cartoon show ever.
I didn't know that. Toth was involved in that too.
Yeah, he did it. He worked on a lot of the designs.
And I remember the there was one of those Treasury editions with Super Friends, and Toth had a page, How I Draw Super Friends or whatever, and I was like, oh man, this is awesome.
Well, you know, that was, I think it was a 12-page story. And that was why people wanted to buy the book. I didn't buy the book.
Ramona Freyden did them.
Yeah, well, I bought the comic book. What Al's talking about, DC used to put together these large, oversized, they were tabloid-sized comic books for a dollar. They sold at convenience stores, sometimes even in toy stores. I love those. I used to always buy them, but for some, and the regular size comic book, Ramona Freyden and another artist are like Kurt Scaifenberger sometimes to do stories. But the Super Friends dollar one, the oversized, Alex Toth did the cover, and he did the interior, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why I never bought it. Years and years later, somebody, I was working at a place that did ads, and somebody was advertising a comic book store, and they sent that actual issue in, the whole book. They wanted to scan part of it to put on this flyer. And I opened it up and looked, and I never noticed that story that started with about how a TV cartoon is made. And it was an Alex Toth drawing. It was just staggering, but he told everything. He told how the inception, how they storyboard the thing, how they record the voices, how they put the voice over it, you know, how they design it. Whole 9 yards in 12 pages. And at the very end, he said, "We do all this for one TV hour and one large film can."
Wow.
And come to find out, they would Xerox that and pass it off at Hanna-Barbera to all the new animators about this is how it's done. And, you know, it was that well. There is a link to that story. I'll put it on the blog so you can see. But it was just genius.
Cool. Hey, Don, time for a music break?
Yeah, well, since we're talking about DJs, this is a good time. I apologize in advance. This is a new band. The bassist is a friend of ours. And Ron Ray. And Dallas will put it in the show notes who it is.
And here we go.
Yeah.
And we're back.
And again, I can't remember the name of the song, but they were local and they're no longer together, so that fits our criteria.
And Ron Ray.
Yeah, the bass player is Ron Ray.
Okay, so moving on with the
animated cartoons. Well, one thing we were talking about was a lot of the cartoons from the 60s and 70s, they were comic book related. And one thing you mentioned was Josie and the Pussycats.
Right, and Archie's Funhouse, but yeah, Josie and the Pussycats.
The Archie's Funhouse, you know, that was Filmation. Al and I both talked about that in, I think, episode 4. The Josie and the Pussycats is one, that cartoon, as soon as it came on, I absolutely loved it. It was more of an adventure style. I'm thinking that's where they changed them to a band. I think before it was called Josie and Her Pals, you know, when it was the Archie comics. I absolutely loved the show. I was just telling Al a story. No, actually, I wasn't. Never mind. It's getting late. But moving on into the 70s, there was a bunch of... Filmation brought Batman back.
Yeah, and Adam West did the voice.
Yeah, I think Burt Ward did the voice of
Robin.
Yeah,
I remember those. I think I have those.
Now, I was working at the time, so I never saw him. Once in a while, I would get up, you know, go to work, and my brother would be watching it. I'm like, what, there's a Batman cartoon on? Of course, you know, this is before VCRs. I couldn't see it. And I just see part of it. I think Batmite was on it as well.
Batmite was on it.
And every once in a while, I get off work and come home, and my brother would be telling me, but man, you should have saw this episode. He said, it was about a mad scientist, and the way they drew the walls while the computer's in it, you would have liked it. You know, and I never saw it. I'd heard somebody later say it was a good cartoon, but I guess they kind of turned Batman into a father figure, teaching Batmite what was right and wrong.
Yeah, I kind of remember that, yeah.
But it looked nice and slick from what I remember. I guess this is 77.
77, right. I don't remember ever seeing it, but I think I have a DVD of it.
And Filmation did a Flash Gordon cartoon.
Oh, that's right. And Mandrake the Magician, too, I think.
Yeah, well, did they?
I think so, yeah.
I just remember NBC had it. I never got to see that. My brother would tell me about it, and I'd see it in magazines. And Bruce Timm, who did all the Batman animated series in the 90s, that was his first job, was working on the Flash Gordon show for Filmation.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Dave Stevens did some animation work, but I think it was for the Godzilla cartoon.
Yeah, the Godzilla cartoon on Hanna-Barbera.
Him and Doug Wilde worked on it. I don't think they're too proud of it, but, you know. Or were too proud of it, actually, you know, but yeah, so. But yeah, Filmation did those, and I'm thinking they did. Was Super Friends going on around at the same time, or did that die out already?
Super Friends started in 1973.
Okay.
And I know it went on all the way through the 80s because they changed it to Challenge of the Super Friends.
That's right.
Yeah. They added more characters to it and everything.
I had read that the Super Friends, they kept toning them down a little bit for a little while anyway because the Legion of Decency or whatever was going after them for violence in the cartoon. So it was, you know, okay, well, let's have them, like, you know, play nice or whatever. You know.
Well, that wasn't just that one. That was all of them.
Didn't they do something with the Warner Brother cartoons, too?
I don't know. I know that it was in 1974. There was, Scholastic always had those school magazines.
Oh, gosh.
And they had you remember those?
Oh, yeah.
I kind of liked them, but they had that League of Decency or whatever in it, and they were going on about wanting Superman and Batman taken off TV. And that also includes the Adam West Batman and the
Stephen Hornet, probably.
Yeah, the George Reeves
Superman.
But they were talking about they felt they were too violent. Well, it seemed like it was 1974 or 75. All of a sudden, cartoons completely changed. Remember there were shows like Lassie's Rescue Rangers? And I never thought about it, but even the Batman cartoon, they were always teaching lessons. It wasn't adventure or anything anymore. It was always, you know, ordinary people, you know, the superheroes had to step in and remember Timmy, you know. It was all the time. There was no violence. There was no action. There was nothing. It was a lot of talking. It was kind of like Leave It to Beaver in tights, you know.
I've never seen those. That was around the time when I was graduating from high school, so I wasn't really watching cartoons at the time.
But it seemed like everything kind of changed to that. But there was, I think, when the 80s rolled around, they did Plastic Man.
Yeah, they did do Plastic Man. Right. Then by the time the 80s came around, you had He-Man and all that stuff coming around, too.
Yeah, it really changed in the 80s. That's
Voltron also.
Well, there was a couple of things. He-Man. I remember I was home from college one time, and they were showing a commercial. It was a He-Man toy. And they kept saying He-Man and Skeletor, and I thought, okay. I didn't know what they were. I remember I went to a grocery store and saw toys, and they had a He-Man figure. I thought it was kind of a funny name to give to a cartoon character or a toy. And then at one point I was watching, the show came on, the cartoon show. I'm like, what? You mean that toy is a cartoon show? That was something you never saw. I'd always heard they did this kind of stuff in Japan, that it'd be a comic book and then they'd animate it and then they'd have a whole line of toys. But that was kind of rare here, you know. And when they did make the toys, it was always a long-run established, like Superman and later Spider-Man, and, you know, Batman. But I started to watch the He-Man cartoon, just wondering what it was about. My brother walked in, what are you watching there? That movie's so sorry. And, you know, I lost interest to watch it. It wasn't like I really... It was meant for, I guess, younger kids than what I was looking for.
Right.
And then, the G.I. Joe. That's when I started making the G.I. Joe and the little tiny figures.
Right. Was that a comic book first, or was it... I think they coincided. Well, I remember the G.I. Joe book when it came out.
G.I. Joe was always that 12-inch tall, you know, action figure, the doll.
Right, right. It was, but when they brought him back, it was just a completely different thing. It was a bunch of action guys or whatever.
In 82, there were the small 5 or 6-inch plastic action figures. But when they showed the commercials for these, they'd have animated commercials.
Real American Hero.
Yeah, and I'm like, oh, where is this from? You know, I never saw this. It was always irritating me. I was wanting to see it. And then by the time I joined the Navy, all the guys in the ship, when work would get off, He-Man would be on TV. And, you know, most of us would just go take a shower, get out of the work clothes, you know, and head off the ship. But some guys would sit there and watch TV. I guess if you had duty or you're restricted to the ship, they'd watch it. Kind of find out a lot of these men had small kids, and that's the show the kids watch. So, you know, you watched it because your kids were interested in it. And I remember one guy on my ship was on restriction. He'd been in trouble and was restricted to the ship for 45 days. And we'd be working. He'd just kind of make fun of it. He goes, hello, I'm Adam, Prince of Eternity. And I said, what is that from? Well, the He-Man cartoon. And, you know, it was just extremely popular. Everywhere you went, you saw people with the figures, people buying the figures. That was just a huge phenomenon. As a matter of fact, we both work with a guy that collects the stuff.
And Marvel did do a comic book.
Yeah, the comic book came later. But one thing I found out from this guy that collected, He-Man was actually supposed to be Conan the Barbarian. It was when Arnold Schwarzenegger did that Conan movie, they were going to have an animated series to coincide with it. I don't know the whole story of what happened to it, but I guess at one point they decided I think they dropped the show. They had a whole series of action figures lined up.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody else did put out some Conan dolls, but it wasn't, I guess, the original.
Yeah, Mego had a Conan doll, I think.
Yeah, and the Warlord from the comic book.
Yep.
But, and that Indian that DC had. Can't think of what it is now.
I don't remember that one.
But anyway, Mattel just...
It wasn't Scowpuncher, was it?
No, I think it was that Arzak.
Oh, yeah, right. The one that Tony Dizeninga did, yeah. Arzak, yeah.
Was it Arzak? Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
But not the Mobius strip.
right, yeah.
But anyway, Mattel had all these prototypes, so they just decided, I guess they lost the license. So they went ahead and made their own, and it was He-Man and Skeletor instead of Conan the Thulsa Doom.
And then, what was it when Thundar the Barbarian came out around the same time?
Yeah, Thundar the Barbarian was actually a show that I did watch, and I absolutely loved it. I had read about it, that it was supposed to be designed by Jack Kirby. They had a Jack Kirby painting, And that opening sequence, it just looks like something Jack Kirby would come up with. I did like the show very well. Reading Alex Toth's, again, that animation book he did in black and white, he talked about it. He said that, according to him, Ruby Spears hired him, and he did all the designs, he did all the work on the show, developed the show, and then they turned around and hired Jack Kirby to do the same thing he did. I thought Jack Kirby designed all of it, and Alex Toth said they hired him to do all the stuff that I'd already done. This is very strange behavior, I think. So I don't know if that stuff was actually designed first by Alex Toth and then Jack Kirby just did his own thing, or...
I thought Kirby was first, but I could be wrong.
That's what I always thought as well. So, I mean, we're not authorities on it, but nevertheless, who did what, it was a fantastic show. I really enjoyed it for the time.
And those were, again, this retro network that we got here, they were showing those, and they weren't bad. They're not bad.
They still stand up?
Yeah, they still stand up. They're kind of fun, you know.
That's the funny thing, is some shows you remember really fondly, and then when you see them again, you think, well, okay, they don't always age well. But, again, I was in college at the time, and I thought they were pretty neat. There was not really too much like that at the time.
Now, you know, we've spanned the 60s, 70s, we're getting into the 80s. We've actually forgotten to talk about maybe the granddaddy of all of these, the Fleischer Superman cartoons from 1941. You remember those? Those are, like, amazing.
Matter of fact, not only do I know them, I've got them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Kirby worked on them.
Yeah, I knew he worked on the Popeye.
He worked on the Superman too.
I never knew that. The first time I ever saw those was DC on those 100-page Super Spectaculars. Once in a while, they'd have a little section in the middle about how their characters have been on the radio, you know, or had TV shows or movie serials. And one of these things it had, it was about Superman in different media. They had the radio show, they had the movie serials, they had the George Reeves, you know, Superman TV show everybody knows, but they had the Superman animated series, but it wasn't the Filmation that we knew, it was the Fleischers. It had a couple of drawings of Superman fighting these really neat looking robots, and it really threw me looking at these little black and white images, because I thought it looks kind of like a real guy, but you could tell it wasn't. It looked like how Joe Shuster used to draw him. I never saw the cartoons. There was a pizza place in Oklahoma that had a movie theater.
Oh, my God. Was it called Figaro's?
No, it was called Crystal's Pizza and Spaghetti.
Okay. Because we had a place like that in Miami, Florida, called Figaro's. That would show 16-millimeter films with the Superman cartoons. That was the first time I ever saw them in the early 80s.
Yeah, that's when I saw them. But they were in black and white.
Right.
But I just remember seeing them. What amazed me, besides everything else, was how they animated the hands.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely beautiful.
Rotoscoping, I think it was.
Well, you know, I've seen rotoscoping, like Ralph Bakshi, who did that Lord of the Rings cartoon.
Lord of the Rings, yeah.
He rotoscoped, but it looked like they just kind of traced real actors.
No, the Supermans were, oh, God, yeah.
I know that the Fleischer brothers, I think they were the ones that came up with the rotoscope.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
but
yeah.
Nevertheless, it was really artistic, and the one I'm talking about, it was Perry White instructing Lois and Clark to go find this story. And it was just people in, you know, plain clothes, suits, and dresses. And Perry White was instructing them, and his hand was pointing. You know, he put his hand on the desk, but it was actual fantastic movement. And, but, you know, it was the cartoon style. But these are amazing. I saw Howard Chaykin at a convention in 82, and he was talking about those cartoons, trying to explain to us too young to remember that they made it look like Joe Shuster and how it moved, and it was some of his favorite work. I think this is in 1988. I was at a comic store in Tampa, and they had this little VHS tape with a blue, it was a white cover with blue and red ink, and it had a model sheet of Superman on it. And it was all the Fleischer Superman cartoons. I think there were 17 of them.
Right.
And on the back it had the story that they paid $1 million an episode, which was unheard of at the time. And they put them out, and they were in color. I never knew they were in color. And I was wanting to get the tape. It was kind of expensive. I think it was $34. This is back in 88. And, you know, a lot of times you buy these tapes and the quality was really bad. And I was asking the guy, it was for a never-ending battle. I guess they're trying to get a monument or rights to Siegel and Schuster. And they said, I asked the guy at the store, was the quality good? And they said, oh yeah, it's outstanding. So I bought it, took it home, and the quality was there. But my wife was a little upset at the price I paid. You know, we were a young couple starting out. And then when she started watching, oh, honey, you're so forgiven. You know, it was, my daughter used to watch that tape and her friends all the time. Fantastic cartoons. That's some of my favorites. And then I found it on a DVD. I never get tired of watching those.
No, those are absolutely wonderful. Those are probably the best animated ever, I think. My opinion.
Yeah, I agree with you. And that was the thing Alex Toth always talked about that as well, that the Fleischer Brothers Superman cartoon was some of the best. Now, when the Batman animated series came out in 92, that was one that just kind of came in under the radar. I saw it in some magazine, and it was right before they started to air it on Fox. And they said that people were really surprised. I guess they showed it at the San Diego convention, and they said people were really amazed. They said it looked like a cross between a Fleischer Superman and anime from Japan. And they had a couple of stills of Batman on top of a car, you know, I think Two-Face is driving it, you know, a couple of things like that. And yeah, it was. It did look like if the Fleischer Brothers kept going on somewhat and started doing more anime work, it would have been that. But Alex Toth always went on about those old Superman animated shows, and yeah, they stand up to this day. They're just fantastic.
Those are Bruce Timm, right?
The Batman animated series?
Yeah.
That's some of my favorites. But you know, in the old Fleischer Brothers Superman, he never flies. He jumps around.
You know, you're right. I never thought about that.
That's
because the actor was jumping around. He wasn't flying, probably.
Yeah. Well, that's Superman couldn't fly in the beginning. That's why they always said he could leap tall buildings at a single bound. And when DC Comics sued Fawcett over Captain Marvel, you know, they finally shut Fawcett down. They just dropped their whole cartoon comic book line. But they that's one thing Superman took. Captain Marvel could fly and Superman couldn't. And that's when Superman started flying. And according to that book, Men of Tomorrow, by Gerard Jones, that's what he talked about, was before Superman just jumped around like a gnat, you know, all the time. But those cartoons, they show the old Superman the way he was created in the 30s.
Right, because, I mean, those cartoons were 41.
Yeah, I think they went up to 41 to 45.
Right, because they were involved in the war years and stuff like that.
Yeah, the one where he's in Japan destroying ships.
Yeah, the Japeteers or something like that, yeah. But yeah, but getting back to the Batman anime, that was kind of like the beginning of the modern era of animation, which is pretty awesome, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there was, in the 80s, there were some other ones. When the G.I. Joe cartoon came out, that one was another one that just hit.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't watch it. Once in a while, something would come on. I'd see parts of it. I was always amazed. I guess that was the big talk, was that a lot of the comic book artists, our comic book writers, started working on it. I can't remember the names. I think Steve Englehart, maybe, and maybe Marty Pascal.
Probably.
Started writing those. But they'd put everything together here and then ship it off to Japan and Korea, and they'd animate it. But pretty nice-looking show. Thundercats was another one again.
That's right, I forgot about that. You know what? What about Battle of the Planets? That was an anime, I think.
Yeah, that was from Japan. And that was actually a manga first that they turned into.
That was a nice one.
Yeah, and they changed it to G-Force.
G-Force, right. Yeah.
But my daughter, I guess in 95, they started showing Cartoon Network as G-Force.
Right.
But they changed a lot of it. Like in Battle of the Planets, one small guy was called Keop, and it was kind of like watching Star Wars, like Chewbacca or R2-D2, where they had dialogue you couldn't understand, but, you know, somebody else would say something. Well, that's how Keop was. Well, in the G4 show, he was called Pee-wee, and he did talk. He was just a young guy. The names are different. I think in Battle of Planets, it was Princess was the girl, and in the G-Force, she was Agatha June. You know, they all had different names.
Okay.
But it was the same show. It was called Gotcha Man in Japan.
Gotcha Man, that's it. Yeah, Gotcha Man.
Yeah, they're supposed to be doing a live action show.
Yeah. I've never seen it, but I have a friend who's into that, and yeah, there is.
And to me, those costume designs they did for that show, or that series, I love those bird helmets and the wings.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't there like Voltron around there? There was Voltron. There was another one called Mazinger, which was like a robot also.
Oh yeah. Well, that's an older one.
Mazinger was an older one.
Yeah, I think that's an old one. I never saw that. I just every once in a while you get some notebook or something with Japanese robots.
Right.
And I remember Mattel had those Shogun Warriors. I think
that's
was
it. That was
of
part
them.
Of the Shogun Warriors. Yeah.
But I think they were all different. A friend of mine I went to college with, Britt. I'm talking about you, friend of the show. He grew up in Hawaii, and I remember he saw one of these notebooks I had, and he goes, oh, I know that. How do you know this? Oh, I know all the Japanese superheroes, because he used to watch them on Japan TV in Hawaii. But I think they were all just different series.
Okay.
But, yeah, Voltron.
It was a comic book, too.
Was it?
There was a Voltron comic book. I think Dick Ayers drew it for The American.
Yeah. But that was, all that stuff was coming out in the 80s. They were starting to show in syndication all the time.
Yeah.
But, I was talking to a guy that worked at Hanna-Barbera, you know, in the mid-80s, and he said there's more work being processed now for animation than there was in the Golden Age. And I said, why? Why is there so much work? He said, toys, because they were selling all the toys.
Mm.
Voltron had a big toy line. Of course, Transformers, that Transformers cartoon.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about
G.I. Joe, they were selling toy, you know, He-Man. But, you know, in the late 70s, it just seemed like everything was going away. The Hanna-Barbera cartoons really started, as far as quality, they really slipped from what they did from the, you know, 60s. And animation, to me, just seemed like it was unimaginative, listless. It didn't seem like they were putting much effort into it. And then all of a sudden, the 80s rolled around, and it really started picking up. There was actually some pretty good shows. And there were some smaller companies popping up. I remember, and they never talked about it now, there was a show in the 80s called the Galaxy Rangers, which my wife and I used to watch. I liked it quite well. But yeah, when the 90s rolled around, to me, that is the golden age of modern animation. The Batman animated series came out, and I just found that whole show staggering. People I worked with was recording it every day so they could watch it. I always go for the visuals, the character designs, the look of the show, but the stories really surprised me as well. They used to always have all kinds of in-jokes. They used all the DC characters, the bad guys, the whole rogues gallery. Sometimes they'd rework them. You know, they had motives for all the characters. I never liked Mr. Freeze until I saw him on the Batman animated series. Really strong 30-minute episodes. But it just kept tying in. The streets would be named after, you know, Dick Kane, you know, or
yeah,
Bob
right.
Kane, Dick Sprang.
It would be on Street, yeah.
Remember one time they had O'Neill and Adams, you know.
Right.
And the whole look of the show was all Art Deco. You know, it was his own world. You know, it's like if the 1940s World's Fair never ended, that's what it looked like. But yet they had TVs and computers in it.
Right.
And I just couldn't get enough of this show. It went on. It was just fantastic.
And that coincided around the same time where the Batman movies were getting popular.
Well, that's why the cartoon came out. When the movies were being done, they wanted a cartoon to coincide. I think they'd had two Batman movies.
Right, and then there was a comic book, too, Batman Adventures by Mike Parabak.
Yeah, Mike. Well, it started out with Ty Templeton.
Ty Templeton, yeah.
And then the whole plan with the comic book, it was after the animated series came out, they put the comic book out. And the editor of the book was talking about, it wasn't really sure how they were going to do it. They were going to have one to coincide, and it was supposed to be for younger kids. But when they hired the artist, you know, the artist has their own style. And he said he wasn't going to mandate the fact that it had to look like the cartoon. Well, Ty Templeton came in, I guess he'd worked on the cartoon, it looked like the cartoon. I don't normally buy books like that, but I did buy it because, one, I like Batman. I love the cartoon, and it did look like the show. So I picked it up. It was pretty good. I guess he did three issues of it, and then Mike Parabek took over. I bought every issue. I think they did about 50 issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I bought every one of them. And then they changed it to The Adventures of Batman and Robin as the show changed its right. title. And I bought every one of those. I remember Ty Temple did a lot of the covers for that one. And staggering work. They changed that book 4 times. From there it went to it was The Batman Adventures, The Adventures of Batman and Robin. Gotham, Batman's Gotham Adventures.
Right, Batman, yeah.
That's
yeah.
when they brought the show back and had Tim Drake as the little Robin, and Batgirl was in it a lot more. And so they changed it. And then they changed it a 4th time. I never knew why, but it's called The Batman Adventures. And I got the first, I wasn't going to buy those. I bought all the others, but I got that one on a free comic book day. I thought, why did they change it? I didn't buy any more. By this time, the comic store I went to went away. But every once in a while, I'd find some issues and pick them up, and that one, the storyline really was interesting. They never, even though they followed the cartoon, they had their own stories. In the Batman Adventures, they had 3 characters that were never in the cartoon. One of them was based on Archie Goodwin, Mr. Nice. But they'd always add little things, and, you know, it was always pretty neat. But that last book they did of the series, the Penguin became the mayor. And in the series, it was always one-shot issues, but it had a continuous storyline. And Batman was trying to, he knew there was some wrongdoing going on. Come to find out, Penguin was a fantastic mayor. He was, Gotham, everything Gotham needed was getting done. He was just a very fantastic, effective neighbor, mayor. And they were basically looking at Batman as this paranoid thug that, you know, had a vengeance for no reason. And the story went on for a while, and finally, come to find out, the Penguin, I guess, bought off all these people and pushed them around to get the mayor's office. So there was wrongdoing there. And then the people completely turned on him and put him in jail. And the whole story ended with the Penguin being upset, says, I gave people everything they wanted. He was a good mayor. It's just how he got the job was the same thing that always made him bad.
Right.
And, you know, and there was some other stories from there. I really enjoyed the series. I ended up on... I was having to go to places that had old issues, and I found them all. But yeah, the Batman anime series, it always remained one of my favorites.
But your favorite is what, Batman Beyond?
Yeah, well, the show, after the Batman show stopped, they started Superman, which, again, was right up there. It was a really bright show. It had a different tone to it, same creative team. I love those as well. Then there was talk that they were going to do a Justice League. I read this on the internet, and I guess the guy was really upset that they weren't going to do the Justice League. They were going to do Batman Beyond, which I had never heard of. What the internet said was they were going to do Justice League, but the toy company, Hasbro, wanted to, or Kenner, they wanted to design the vehicles to be put in the show. And Bruce Timm said no, so they worked on Batman Beyond. And the guy on the site kept saying, what would you rather see, Justice League or Batman Beyond? Well, to me, it was Justice League because I never heard of Batman Beyond. And Batman Beyond came out, and to me, it just hit the ground running. Everything was fantastic. The music on all these shows was always really, really strong. But Batman Beyond, it sounded like the Chemical Brothers when it came on. My daughter didn't like all the purples they used on the show. You know, the whole color palette.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
Well, the color palette on each show was different. The Batman animated series, they were having trouble with the backgrounds. So what they started doing was using black backgrounds, and they'd paint over it, which gave it that whole dark deco look they always call it. The Superman show, the color palette was really bright, you know. Superman.
Yeah, obviously, yeah.
But the Batman Beyond... everything. The cities were different. Just watching it, just to see the technology. They had elevators that, you know, basically they were subway trains that went up the skylines. I guess people like us who live on the lower levels and the rich people who live up high. But some of the stuff that they came up with, of course now it's kind of happened, but some of it, the technology and ideas they had, it just never stopped. It was always a 30-minute movie. I love the whole ideas behind it. I never get tired of watching that. That's always remained my favorite.
You know, I never really watched that one that much, but I guess you're going to loan those to me at some point.
Yeah, I bought every one of them. My daughter told me the Batman anime series was out on a DVD set, and I immediately went and bought it. And each time one came out, I bought it. And I continued. With Batman Beyond, every time it would come out, I'd get it on Amazon. Couldn't wait to watch it. And, yeah, it never stopped. What was strange about this show they talk about was it was intended for a younger audience. I don't know who, I guess it was WB. It was on Fox, the Batman show.
I think WB did do some of those.
Well, when WB came about, they had their own cartoon package. That's where the Superman show came out. And then, I guess after it had been on a while, they brought back the Batman show. And that's when they brought in Tim Drake, and they kind of streamlined it, redesigned some of the characters. Which I didn't care for when I saw in a magazine announcing it. I said, why do they have to change it? And when I saw the show, I loved it. And then the Batman Beyond, the WDB, was wanting them to tone it down and be more of a kid-friendly show.
Hmm.
And so they did put the show together, but it wasn't toned down. I think they intended to, but it was actually a lot more violent than Superman and Batman had ever been.
All right.
One thing I loved about those is how, again, it had a... I'm not a continuity fan. I don't like it when, you know, they mandate you can't do this because of that. I think in the late 70s, DC was very interesting because they could never really change Batman and Superman. It was the same thing all the time. It wasn't in the 80s when they rebooted Superman and started changing it. Now they let you do a lot more. But that cartoon, even so, it was the same creative team behind things, and it just kept building. Everything that was in Superman didn't contradict what had happened in Batman, and it kept building on. And even the same voice actors for Batman was on it. But the show never stopped. It just continued on. And Batman Beyond continues to be my favorite.
And the Justice League came out after that, right?
Yeah, the Justice League came on. It was on Cartoon Network. And, again, most of the creative team was still there. I was excited about it because, as a kid, the Justice League was my favorite. And we'd watch them, my daughter and I. But even though I liked it, I didn't like it as well. It didn't seem like there was as much to it. A friend of mine at work came by one time and said, I'm so underwhelmed by that Justice League cartoon.
But, you know, just the fact that they were bringing in, like, Metamorpho and all these characters, which is a favorite of mine, was, like, really freaking me out. Because it was like, wow, it's not just Superman and Batman and all the villains. It's like Jonah Hex and Metamorpho and the Blue Beetle.
Oh, yeah.
And that was just like, oh, my God, really?
Well, they were great fun. I loved and Metamorpho, how he ended up being a friend of Jon Stewart's, the Green Lantern, because, you know, they knew each other from the Marines. They kind of changed things in the comics, but it made sense. I did enjoy it. I guess they changed the time or something. I never saw the second season. I saw a couple of parts.
Right.
But I didn't see most of them. I have to say my favorite Justice League episode was the one where they went on an alternate Earth and they had the different heroes. They had Tom Turbine.
I remember that. That was cool.
I love that one. They had it was basically a golden age or silver age from the 50s, late 50s, the Justice League cartoon or comic book. I couldn't get tired of that.
And there was Justice League Unlimited, too.
Well, the Justice League Unlimited. There was two seasons of Justice League, and it all ended with Hawk Woman. Or Hawk Girl, I guess Thanagar came to invade Earth.
Yeah.
And there was three parts. And then when that finished, they had, they didn't know the show was going to be, I thought that was it. And they said they want to go out with a bang. They sure did. the satellite was destroyed. Hawk Girl was, you know, gone. And I thought, wow, that's something. Well, they did bring it back as Justice League Unlimited, which I honestly thought I would hate. The one thing I liked about these is there wasn't too many superheroes. These companies, as they go on longer and longer, it just seems like there's 50 billion superheroes all over the place, and it just gets to be too much, you know. And as the thing with the Justice League, as a kid, I did like that everybody in the planet was on the comic at one time or another. But I just started thinking it probably wouldn't make for a good show. And then when Justice League Unlimited came out, I thought, well, here we go. But I really enjoyed the show a lot.
That's awesome.
But the second season of Justice League, the cartoon got a lot more robust. I guess they were trying to calm it down for kids and then picked it up. And Unlimited, I guess it always amazed me. It had so many different characters and they pulled it off. I know because I read most of the comic books as a kid, but I think even if you're a new viewer, you got enough of each character to know what was going on.
Yeah, I mean, you know who Green Lantern is and everybody is, you know. But, you know, honestly, the one that they just did, I think it was just canceled, The Brave and the Bold.
Yeah.
That is one of my favorites.
Well,
It looks like Dick Sprang or something like that.
That was actually a really neat show. My daughter loved it. Now, by this time of my life, I didn't have too much time to watch TV anymore. And she would watch and tell me about it. And every once in a while, I'd catch an episode with her. She loved it. She grew up under the Batman animated series, and I would try to explain to her about the old comics. Batman had a blue, you know, it was blue and gray. He had the blue mask, the blue cape, the blue gloves. You know, she grew up, it was all black and gray. And I would show her some old Justice League reprints I had, and one thing I never thought about, she goes, he's smiling. You know, in those old ones, Batman was smiling, you know, which to me, you know, that was how he was. Well, when the animated series came out, people would always refer to it as the sinister Batman. Well, you know, he wasn't sinister, he was serious, but he had his, you know, there was bright moments on the cartoon.
There was light moments, yeah.
But the Batman, Brave and the Bold, she always giggled about it because she loved, especially when Aquaman was on. I guess they made him a Greek.
right. Yeah.
And, I always thought that was clever. I didn't see a lot of the episodes. It was great fun. But she said, you know, in the show, she said it's all the guest superheroes are kind of way out there and kind of crazy, and Batman's kind of like the even temper. He's like, okay, let's just get it done. He's the calming force. But you know, he was the Batman I knew in those reprints. He smiled. He was more of a swashbuckler.
Right,
you know?
Right. I like that.
Well, I do too. I like them both ways. Like I said, the animated series, the
old
ones.
Darker.
I love those. That's still to me. I bought all the DVDs. That's my favorite series, and it always will be. And it started out, and all the way to the end of the Justice League Unlimited, which I take it you haven't seen.
No, I'm watching it now.
Okay, well, it ties.
Well, I saw a few of them when they came out, but I'm just watching the series now. Completely.
But the end of the Justice League Unlimited, it was basically a perfect bookend for all those series, starting from the animated series all the way up. The Cadmus whole thing went on Justice League Unlimited, which I was kind of surprised they did in a cartoon, but I really enjoyed it. But I guess that originated in the comics. I never read them.
I think so. Yeah.
But it was a character named Amanda Waller, and the whole government, you know, thing, and how they were shutting them down and controlling them. But just how the whole series ended, I thought, well, that's just perfect. And Batman Beyond, they showed him a little bit in the future at times. And I thought, this just doesn't stop. But The Brave and the Bold, the episodes I saw, it was great fun. I've heard people talk about it. Zenorama, you know, again, we mentioned there's a sidebar link to him from our blog. He's reviewed them. I think he's really enjoyed them quite well. But the one, I don't know if they ever aired, they showed it, it's online, but Batman and Space Ghost was on Brave and the Bold.
Oh, I don't know if they ever showed that. That's a great combo.
Well, the whole thing, I found it online. I'll try to link it to the blog. I think I found this out from Zenorama. If that's true, thank you very much, David. But I watched it on my computer, which I'm not a big fan of watching things on a computer, but I couldn't look away. It had a Space Ghost, Janet Jace, the monkey, what was his name? Blip. Yeah, Blip. It was just, it. When you saw it, you couldn't help but see an old episode of Space Ghost. And then Batman flies in some kind of space bat plane, looked like, you know, the Space Ghost cruiser. And, again, it was all swashbuckly. I want to say Gary Owen did the voice. I don't know if that's true or not.
Yeah, he might have. I think he's still alive.
If it wasn't Gary Owen, the guy was great. I would love to have a copy of that.
I don't know if that ever came out. That might have been something you saw on there that they never released.
It was on. I'm guessing maybe it was on Hulu. I'll find it and show it.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
But it, they did say, I guess they kind of canceled the series, and there was a few of them they never put out. How that ended up on the internet, it was some legal thing. It wasn't like some fan stuck it up for something.
Oh, it was like a Hanna-Barbera thing or something like that?
I don't know where it was. It was one of the episodes, but, I mean, they put it online, and it was professionally done. I mean, it was out there.
Well, we will investigate that.
But, yeah, it was fantastic, and that was an extremely popular and well-loved show. And I'm really surprised they actually canceled it, if they did stop it.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm sure there'll be another one coming out pretty soon, so.
Yeah, well, they're putting out all those direct-to-DVD shows. The New Frontier was one of them, which I absolutely loved, and then found out Dallas wasn't a fan of animation.
Okay, it's interesting, because he loved the comic book and the animation. Well, you know what, we'll get him. We'll get him to be a fan. We'll get him.
Well, you know, everybody has their own likes, but to me, it was always a very fine line between animation and comic books.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's one thing always fascinated me. I guess in Japan, I think there's a few exceptions, but most of the time, it is usually a comic book first. It's a manga first, and then they animate it. And sometimes they do them at the same time. I always liked that. I wish there was more of that here. But
yeah, me too. But hey, listen, man, we've talked a lot about animation, and right now, we need to talk about Dallas's favorite segment. What are you reading this week, Don?
Oh, okay. What I just picked up was Roy Crane's Captain Easy, Soldier of Fortune. It's from Fantagraphic Books. This is the second volume. They put two. I imagine they're going to put four out. I think that's what the plan is. This thing is an oversized. It's reprints from the Sunday newspapers. For those of you that don't know Captain Easy, Roy Crane, who most of us remember as the artist for Buzz Sawyer, he put out a strip that I'd always hear people talk about, but I'd never seen it until, I think the late 80s or early 90s. They had NBM put out books called Wash Tubs and Captain Easy. They were black and white reprint books. I saw them in Berkeley, California. I was kind of fascinated with it. I picked them up. I got two of them. It was a daily strip called Wash Tubs, and later they added Captain Easy, which was some kind of mysterious soldier of fortune. In these NBM books, they took the Captain Easy Sunday pages, and I guess they cut up the panels to fit the format. But I thought, these are fantastic. I figured when I came off vacation, I'd pick them up. Never saw them again. The books are out of print, and that was that. Well, Fantagraphics announced they were going to print these out, just absolutely outstanding. The Sunday pages back then was one full newspaper page. A Little Nemo was printed that way, Popeye was printed that way, and so was Captain Easy. And he just goes from one place to another. Anyway, I love the first of Sumatra. When this came out, I just got it. It's staggering. Roy Crane had it was an adventure strip, but his characters had a bit of a simple cartoony style. Bright, bouncy, simple patterns. I just can't get enough of it.
It's interesting because this is like an awesome, gorgeous book. But I was always, the Roy Crane that I always knew was the Buzz Sawyer with the duotone paper with all the, you
right,
know, different, but in color. This thing's beautiful. This thing's, I'm going to get one. This thing is just, you know, beautiful.
Well,
Roy Crane's one of my favorite guys. This is a guy that kind of like, his work is realistic yet cartoony, you know, and that's one of the most difficult things you can do.
It is. Actually, the first time I ever heard of Captain Easy was the underground cartoonist Von Bode.
Cheech Wizard.
Yeah, the Cheech Wizard from National Lampoon. He was a huge fan of Roy Crane's. I knew Roy Crane from Buzz Sawyer, and I don't know why, whenever I hear Captain Easy, I always think of an airplane pilot. But when I saw the NBM stuff, I was really amazed. Like I said, I bought two of the books and wanted to get more. I saw a Smithsonian book on newspaper strips, which was nice, and they had one of the Captain Easy pages in it. It kind of fascinated me, because when NBM cut up the panels, you know, they blew some up, shrunk some to fit. And when I actually saw the page all on its own in color, it completely changed. I still like the NBM strips because for some reason we see the large panels, it changes everything. Again, when I see these, it makes me want to draw. But the Buzz Sawyer work, he did use the dual tone, as Al mentioned, but he had a... It was a bit more detailed, a bit more realistic. This, it was a little more fun. He kept it simple. It was, again, I say bouncy. It looked more like animation. And again, it was more high adventure. I guess a lot of the old stuff, they had a lot of mercenaries running around country to country doing whatever they wanted, and that's... I don't think they ever really explained what Captain Easy was. He appeared in Wash Tubs, kind of almost like a criminal element. He had a southern accent, but I guess he met him in China or Tibet or somewhere. And after that, in the daily strip, they were always fast friends. And then when they started up the Sunday strip, it was just Captain Easy. It's just a fantastic character. I love the work. I love Buzz Sawyer just as much, but this is, again, some of my favorites.
I mean, I don't own this book, but I'm already giving it a 10 out of 10.
Yeah, well... All right, well, if I have to grade it, the artwork is absolutely a 10. The story, I'm going to say about a 6. They're great, fun, high-adventure things. I'd love to see these animated. I don't think, you know, they'd ever put it out, but it would make a nice animated series if people went for those kind of adventure strips again.
Yeah, it looks like, you know, you're right. I could see, like, today's animators doing something really cool with this.
Well, because he went everywhere. I mean, those NBM strips, the ones I bought, he was in, I guess it was Mongolia. And then, you know, from there he switched over to China. But, you know, it was always unique. He goes country to country. He was in India. He's back in the South. He's in Louisiana. They go to Germany. Sometimes he makes up his own countries. But, you know, they have those styles. But it's just one thing after another. He's always by the seat of his pants, you know. He's in jail, he's somewhere else, but it doesn't stop. I was happy when I've been following this for years. Fantagraphics announced it. They were going to do this in, I guess, Pogo and Prince Valiant. They were going to put Prince Valiant out. Fantagraphics has published Prince Valiant several times. But they were going to do it again. But this one I was following for a couple of years, and then they announced when it was going to come out. And then they backed it up, and they kept backing it up. Finally, it came out. But the second one just came out, I guess, in August. It's, again, they're staggering. I'm going to get every one.
Was this Fantagraphics who put this
yeah.
out? Wow, they're really good. And they're doing the Charlie Browns, too. Wow, they're doing a great job on all this stuff.
Well, you know, when they announced the Charlie Brown stuff way back, that's one that kind of gets me. One, I loved Charlie Brown when I was a kid. I know Dallas is a huge fan of it.
Peanuts.
But, yeah, Peanuts. But the thing is, I've seen that for so many years all my life, and there's so many reprints. To me, I've just lost interest in it. But when Fantagraphics was announced they were going to put them out, those packages they did were just...
beautifully designed.
Yeah, it was a Chester Brown. Who was it that...
I don't know. Was it Chester Brown?
It was one of their cartoonists did the design. I don't know. Maybe it wasn't Chester Brown. It was one of their cartoonists that did the design. They used the actual Charles Schulz artwork, but the package is just staggering. The books are really nice looking. And I was reading an interview with Gary Groth, and he said he got to know Charles Schulz, and they talked, and it was basically to put out the books. And then Charles Schulz died, and so he sat it aside. He said, well, you know, it's bad form. And then later, I guess, Charles Schulz's family came and said, well, we're ready. You were going to put these out. My dad wanted them out, and, you know, let's do them. Well, do them they did. They were really nice. One thing, Charles Schulz did not want the first 2 years of the strip to come out. And I saw in one of the magazines they're announcing it, they had, I guess, the actual first Charlie Brown strip. I thought it was greatness. It showed these two boys sitting on the curb. And it showed Charlie Brown walk by in the forefront. And the one kid says, well, there goes Charlie Brown. And the next panel, he said, good old Charlie Brown. And then the third panel, the same two boys sitting in the curb, says, yeah, everybody likes good old Charlie Brown. And the last panel, the boy says, how I hate him. And, you know, you can't help but laugh. I said, wait a minute, what? And, I always thought that was hilarious. I guess the strip started, they were selling it to college newspapers because nobody would touch
right.
it.
Right.
And I've never read the other ones, but I just thought that was actually great fun. And it wasn't the Charlie Brown that I'd seen for so many years. From what I understand, he didn't want those first 2 years put out, but they finally agreed. I guess they convinced him. But the packages are staggering, and the interviewer was talking about that to Gary Groth about money, and maybe this will be a success. And Gary Groth made a joke about, I hope so, finally. Gary Groth has always put out some fantastic work at Fantagraphics, the whole Love and Rockets, which are right at the top of my very favorites. But I think they always, even though they had success, I think the success has always kept them on a shoestring. And when the Charlie Brown books came out, it was, I guess, a pretty successful windfall, which, you know, well deserved. And then after that, they didn't sit on the laurels. They started putting out, I guess they put out the Dennis the Menace. I guess that was them.
Yeah, they did Dennis the Menace. They did Little Lulu.
Yeah, from there it just kept going. They're really nice old reprints of comic strips from the newspaper, and they're hardbacks, and they're nice collections, and they're affordably priced. And then there are some other companies that put out... Fantagraphics also doing the Popeye.
Right, Popeye.
Which I have to say, I don't care for the covers of those, how they did them, but the interiors, it's a fantastic job what they've done. I love those old Popeye strips.
This is really kind of like, we're talking about golden ages of animation. This is really the golden age of reprints, because there's a lot of beautiful hardcover books coming out of all these strips, and they're doing them right. You know, the from the originals, you know, the original colors, you know, great repro. A little pricey, but hey, you can get a good deal if you look around.
But I'm really happy to see all these news. And there's another company putting out the Terry and the Pirates work. Really nice volumes. And I'm happy that these things are coming out, and these really nice volumes being reprinted. And it's not just Fantagraphics doing it, and they're really high quality.
Yep, definitely, yeah. Yeah, they get a 10 for packaging, too.
Yeah. So, okay, go ahead, Al. What are you reading at this time?
Well, interesting. Okay, the other day I was watching TV, and I saw, you know, they were playing on one of the cable channels the movie Ghost World. I said, oh, you know, that's a comic book movie. Maybe I should watch it. Maybe I can talk about it, or maybe read the comic book. Well, I'd never originally seen it because, you know, I didn't. The subject matter didn't interest me. It's about two girls, you know, gotten out of high school. They look kind of, you know, it just didn't interest me. I know Daniel Klaus, the writer, was good, and I always liked 8-Ball and Lloyd Llewellyn, but I never got around to reading it. So I watched this movie. It's a great movie, one of my favorite comic book movies ever. You know, it was the story of two girls who just get out of high school, and they're kind of like outcasts. But, you know, they have a few adventures, and, you know, they get into a little bit of trouble. But great movie, great acting by Scarlett Johansson, Thora Birch as Enid, the main character, and Steve Buscemi as her friend, who later becomes a love interest. I don't want to give too much away. But anyway, I read the comic book. And the comic book is excellent also. I mean, you know, Klaus is a great artist. It seemed to me like they took stories from the... I think the comic book was only like a 5-issue series. I read the graphic novel. You could see parts of the storyline in the comic book was used for the movie, but the movie is kind of different in the sense that the relationship that one of the girls has, Enid, who's the main character... In the book was with another kid, which was more her age, but in the movie, she befriends Steve Buscemi, who's like a record collector, and then they become... It's very complicated. It's very well done, and it has kind of a real melancholy ending, but I actually ended up liking the movie more than the comic book, and I really like the comic book. So, you know, definitely... Check it out. Check both of them out. Make up your own mind. But yeah, Ghost World, really, really good stuff. Really insightful as far as like, you know, when you get kind of like when you're in high school, it's one thing. But when you get out and go into the real world, you can kind of like get into. It gets a little stickier, and then they also get into like, you know, issues like real art versus like, you know, like well. I don't know how to explain it. There's a couple of scenes where she's going to, she's taking a remedial art class, and they talk about, you know, what supposedly is real art and what isn't. it kind of hit home to me from when I was in art school, and you know, you'd have to watch it for yourself. But and then there's a she's an artist in the movie anyway, and some of the drawings that she does were actually drawn by Robert Crumb's daughter, Sophie Crumb. So
oh,
that
yeah.
was really interesting. Yeah. Yeah, and I was wondering, wow, who did those? And there's a few references to Robert Crumb in them too, because there's one scene where Buscemi's like he's a blues record collector, and the girl who befriends him goes over to his he's selling records at near his house, and she buys one of them, but then she asks him, that record there, is there any good? And it's an old Robert Crumb record, and the guy goes, nah, it sucks. Take this other one. And I just, and, you know, I just got it, and it was hilarious, you know. But and there's a lot of moments like that, and I'm pretty sure the director of the movie was the guy who directed the Crumb biography,
yeah.
which is a great movie, but it's difficult too.
That one's outstanding. I have seen that.
Yeah, that family was definitely like interesting.
Well,
you know,
on a funny note, talking about Robert Crumb, I was in college. I'd seen his work. Every time you went to a comic store, you'd see Zap Comics in the underground section, which I wasn't allowed to go to. But I knew the style. The Keep On Trucking poster everybody had,
right.
You know. It was on everything, T-shirts and all that. You could even go in some of the discount stores, and they'd have the Stoned Again poster hanging up.
Right.
And so I knew who Robert Crumb was, and then they'd always talk. And I knew he did the Janis Joplin Cheap Thrills album. But then I always thought he was dead. I thought he was gone.
Moved to France.
Well, but I mean, I'm talking about in the late 70s. For some reason, whenever I read anything about him, it was always brief, but it always sounded past tense. And I remember when I was in college, I saw that poster he did of the America. They had the corner, you know, as a gas station, or I guess as a wood.
Yeah, area. As it changes, America,
yeah.
Like in the old
and it
days.
Finished
modern.
America the Ugly,
yeah.
You know. Absolutely thought that was genius. But I saw this around 1980, and I thought Robert Crumb was dead. So you can imagine my shock in 1987 or 88 when Fantagraph of the Comics Journal interviewed Robert Crumb, found that he was still alive, and instead of this really hip hippie that, you know, everybody thought he was this kind of fuddy-duddy that I guess should have been around in the 20s.
Right.
And but that Fantagraphic interview, I lent it to a mutual friend of ours who's a big Robert Crumb fan. You can't stop reading it, and it's just, you can't make this stuff up. And then the documentary, it covers all the same stuff again. It's fantastic. It's
Oh, yeah. And his daughter's really good. I mean, those pages that you know, of her sketchbook, which she shows to Buscemi at one point in the story, it's like, wow, this is really cool. I mean, I didn't know who drew it until I looked at the very last page. I mean, at the credits at the end, and I was like, wow. And if you watch the movie, stay to the end after the credits, because there's a scene at the end that's pretty hilarious. That was kind of like an outtake, but yeah. But the movie's great. It really is. I give that movie a 10, and I give the book a 9. Honestly, the movie's great. The performances are great on it. Buscemi rocks as usual. And I usually don't like comic book movies. But this one is great, and the book is too. So that's what I was reading this week.
Well, that sounds good. Was the movie animated, or was it live action?
No, it's a live action movie.
Wow,
yeah.
That's something else.
Yeah, Thora Birch, Scarlett Johansson, Steve Buscemi. There's a couple of other people too. Ileana Douglas. I forgot. I think somebody called Dave. David Cross, who was in. I can't remember the show he was in. But yeah, no, it's a. It's a live-action movie from 2001. I thought it was more recent, but it's 2001. So it's probably, even though I've never seen it, it's probably like along the lines of something like American Splendor or something
that.
I haven't seen that one, but I'm going to try to, because if it's just as good or better or whatever, I mean, it's just one of those things. It was like 10 o'clock at night. I was watching TV, and I was like, hey, you know, what the hell? You know, just watch it.
Very good.
Yeah.
Very good.
So yeah, that's what I read this week. So, is that all we got, man?
Yeah, I think that's been enough.
This is a marathon show again. So,
Yeah, well, I miss Dallas. He's always the voice of reason. So hopefully he'll be back to keep us in
straight. There is no reason in this show. This is an unreasonable show, and it has no direction.
Absolutely no direction.
And you know what? All the better for it.
See ya.